From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. When faced with a terminal illness, can non-medical factors, like the patient's attitude, change a prognosis? On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Dr. David Spiegel. In a groundbreaking study, he found that women with breast cancer lived longer if they were part of a support group. Spiegel is critical of modern medicine for focusing on the disease, not the person with it. But he also criticizes alternative medicine for believing you can wish away an illness. Also today, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new recording of Beethoven's Violin Concerto by Nigel Kennedy. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The UN Security Council has unanimously approved a resolution that would reimpose sanctions against Haiti. Among other things, the order would block oil shipments to Haiti and freeze the country's assets overseas. It would go into effect unless Haiti's military rulers guarantee that they'll keep to the agreement to restore the country's elected government. Members of the Senate have been meeting behind closed doors today, trying to reach agreement on a deadline for the withdrawal of U.S. forces from Somalia. Democratic Senator Robert Byrd outlined an amendment to the defense spending bill that calls for withdrawal 2 months before the president's deadline. Senate leaders hope to head off that proposal with one of their own. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
Byrd had originally wanted U.S. troops out of Somalia by the end of the year. Now he proposes to cut off funds for the operation after February 1st. The West Virginia Democrat says he is not trying to micromanage foreign policy.
We do have, nevertheless, a very clear constitutional responsibility to address the broad policy issue of when we raise and support armies to go into battle.
Senate Democratic and Republican leaders, meanwhile, are trying to gather votes for an amendment supporting the president's March 31st deadline, giving him the option of extending the troop stay beyond that with congressional approval. Finding that consensus, however, is proving difficult, and votes on the competing measures will not be until tomorrow at the earliest. This is Brian Naylor at the Capitol.
Bell Atlantic, the regional telephone giant, announced plans today to acquire Telecommunications Incorporated in one of the largest corporate mergers ever. The bill would make Bell Atlantic one of the leaders in the burgeoning interactive media and information distribution industry. NPR's Jim Zeroli reports.
Bell Atlantic Chairman Ray Smith called the deal the perfect information age marriage. Taken together, the telephone company and the cable operator TCI serve 42% of U.S. households. If the merger goes through, the new company would be the sixth largest in the United States. Smith said the new company would make a major investment in fiber optic and other technologies. Customers would then have access to an almost unending array of interactive media and information distribution services. Smith said the deal represents a step forward in building the much-discussed information superhighway that could give customers access to any library, film, or database in the world from their homes. The merger must still be approved by the Justice Department, which is expected to study the deal carefully, but company officials expressed confidence today that approval would come. In New York, this is Jim Zeroli reporting.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 10 points to close at 3,603. Declines led advances by a slight margin in heavy trading. This is NPR. A Louisiana judge ruled today that former Ku Klux Klan leader David Duke didn't violate state campaign finance laws during his run for governor in 1991. The judge said he found technical violations of the law, but said he didn't think Duke or his campaign willfully broke the law. The state ethics board had filed the suit, alleging that Duke's campaign broke rules against anonymous contributions. Charges have been filed against the first of the alleged ringleaders of last week's armed uprising in Moscow. A former Soviet Army general is accused of leading an attempt to overthrow the government and organizing mass disturbances. The BBC's Robert Parsons has more from Moscow.
Retired Soviet Army General Albert Makashov gambled everything on the night of October the 3rd, when he led an attempt by supporters of the Russian parliament to seize Moscow's central television center, Astankina. In the event, The attempt failed when crack army units came to the television center's defense, but it had been very close. Once the coup collapsed, General Makashov was a marked man. Not only had he led the attacks on Ostankina and the Moscow mayor's office, he had also organized the defense of the White House, the Russian parliament building. So it comes as no surprise that he's the first of the six ringleaders of the attempt to overthrow President Yeltsin to be charged.
Robert Parson in Moscow. There were reports of more fighting and more misery today in Bosnia. Electricity was cut off to Sarajevo after several weeks of relatively uninterrupted power in the Bosnian capital. It wasn't clear whether power lines were deliberately cut or damaged by fighting. There was more fighting reported between Muslims and Croats in Vitez, a town about 30 miles north of Sarajevo, and that delayed a planned prisoner exchange between the two sides. One Red Cross relief convoy continued its return from a besieged Muslim enclave in North Bosnia, turned back by a landmine. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Dr. David Spiegel is a psychiatrist who works with people who have life-threatening illnesses. He says he's found that the best way to face the threat of serious illness is to look it right in the eye, to face the worst, rather than simply to hope for the best. Dr. Spiegel is a professor of psychiatry at Stanford University School of Medicine, where he's been studying the connection between the body and the mind. He conducted a landmark study on the value of support groups for women with metastasized breast cancer. Perhaps you saw the documentary on his work, which was featured on the Bill Moyers series Healing in the Mind. Dr. Spiegel has written a new book about facing life-threatening illness called Living Beyond Limits. He's critical of how both modern medicine and alternative medicine deal with illness.
I think the problem with modern medicine is what I like to think of as mindless materialism. The model in modern medicine is that the body is a machine like a car, and that if something goes wrong, you just replace the part. And we're so focused on high-tech intervention and on what I think of as the myth of cure. We really have, rather than a health care system, a disease cure system, in which the whole focus of medical intervention is thought to be curing illness. When the fact is that most Americans live with and die of chronic illnesses like heart disease, cancer, and stroke, and what people need from their doctors is caring, is learning how to live with these serious illnesses. So while certainly we should go for a cure whenever it's possible, I think we've lost sight of the oldest tradition of medicine, which is to cure rarely, to relieve suffering often, and to comfort always. And I think we've got it backwards, and we need to get back on the old track of what medicine is all about.
Now, you have your criticisms of alternative medicine, too.
Yes, indeed. Now, the other extreme is the alternative approach, which I call disembodied spiritualism. And the idea there is that if you fix a problem in your head, it will automatically and magically get fixed in your body. So if you just visualize white cells killing cancer cells, boom, somehow that will help happen in your body. And ironically, that movement has the same myth of cure, the idea that somehow you can fix it if you just wish it away. And there's just no evidence that that works. And I think it lays a terrible burden of guilt on people who, when their disease progresses, as many diseases do, they then are left with a feeling guilty that they didn't visualize well enough and cure themselves of a disease. And I think that's a pernicious myth as well.
Do you think of yourself as working someplace in between modern medicine and alternative medicine?
No, I don't think so, actually. I'm a physician, I'm a psychiatrist, and I have the highest regard for the tradition of medicine. And what I would like to do is redefine medicine. I think this is not alternative medicine, it's not complementary medicine, it's just good medicine to help a person cope with an illness and not just focus on the technical narrow interventions.
Now, you've said that you started your support group study expecting to prove that there wasn't a connection between survival and positive thinking. Why did you expect that you would find no connection, especially as a psychiatrist? Why did you expect that that connection wouldn't exist?
Well, being a psychiatrist teaches you modesty, and you learn that there are tough problems that you come up against. And I, knowing what I know about cancer and its progression, I thought that we could help people live better with it, that we could help reduce their anxiety and depression and even help them control pain. But I was not prepared for the evidence that we found that enhancing social support and coping with disease might have an effect on the rate of progression. I'm interested in the problem, but the effect we found was just far stronger than anything I would have guessed at the beginning.
Share with us what the results were.
Well, we had 86 women who were assigned by what we call a randomization, in which you allow the toss of a coin or a computer to select who gets a year of weekly support group interventions and who gets just routine, standard, excellent medical oncology care. And we found after the initial year that the women who got the intervention, that was 50 of the 86, were less anxious and depressed and had half the pain. But what was much more surprising was that by the end of 4 years, all of the control group had died and a third of the treatment sample were still alive. And the average survival time for the intervention sample was 18 months longer than that in the control group.
Now you're doing a similar study. Why are you doing it again?
Well, I think, you know, many doctors have taken the point of view that we need more evidence, and I agree with that point of view. I feel we need more evidence. I believe this study. I took 3 years to reanalyze the data to make sure there wasn't anything wrong with it before I published it in 1989. At the same time, this phenomenon is so important that it had better be right. And so we want to be sure that with a new sample of patients using the same kind of intervention, we will find out whether or not we will again see a survival difference. And if we do, I think we will have established it more strongly than we did the first time. I'm glad to see that there are now two other studies that used randomized design, one by Dr. Richardson at University of Southern California and one just published last month by Dr. Fauci at UCLA, showing that cancer patients that got various kinds of psychosocial support interventions lived longer than patients who had routine care. So there are beginning to be other studies consistent with ours.
Can you interpret the results? Why do you think it is so that women with breast cancer who were in a support group lived longer than their counterparts who didn't have that support group?
Well, there, you know, it seems almost mystical, but there are a number of studies that show that social integration is a powerful variable in mortality. This was reviewed in Science several years ago by James House. And in general, the relative risk of dying if you're socially isolated is elevated as much as if you had high serum cholesterol or smoked. It's a powerful relationship, and yet we ignore it, pay little attention to it. I think there are four possible mechanisms that could account for what we observed with breast cancer patients. The first is what I like to think of as the grandmother effect. Perhaps people who are less anxious and depressed and are coping with their disease better do all the things your grandmother told you to do: eat well, sleep well, and get plenty of exercise. So it may be sort of the body maintenance things that these people do better. The second possibility is that they make better use of their health care, that they get diagnostic tests when they need them, that they adhere better to treatment regimens, and get more vigorous treatment. They may elicit more vigorous treatment. You know, the doctor sees a woman who has lots to live for, has a book she wants to write or a project she wants to do, and figures, okay, we'll go that extra mile and give the next round of chemotherapy. So that's a second possibility. The third involves the endocrine system. Stress causes our body to release hormones like cortisol and prolactin in higher amounts. And these hormones have been shown to stimulate the growth of tumor cells, particularly breast cancer. That's why we often use estrogen receptor blockers like tamoxifen and Megase to slow the progression of cancer. So it is possible that if you handle stress better and if social support acts like a stress buffer, you may be reducing your own body's tendency to stimulate the growth of the tumor that's in it. And the fourth possible mechanism involves the immune system. We now know that the nervous system and the immune system talk to each other, that white blood cells that attack cancer cells respond to neurotransmitters, the chemicals that one nerve secretes to stimulate another nerve to action. We also know that cytokines, which are secreted by the white blood cells involved in the immune system, affect the central nervous system, and that stress can reduce the functioning of certain parts of the immune system, can increase vulnerabilities to infection, and that social support can buffer that block. So it's possible that in some way being a part of the group helped these women's immune systems function better.
I want to make it clear that you're not saying that positive thinking alone is going to help you a lot. You say denial and overly optimistic attitudes are not helpful.
Terry, that's absolutely right. I'm a proponent of realistic thinking, not positive thinking. In fact, the women in our group call that alternative point of view the prison of positive thinking. And an example is some woman started to cry and her husband said, "Stop crying, you'll make the cancer spread." Who needs that? What we try to do is help people realistically face what's ahead of them. And that means face the disease and its treatment, the fact that it may well shorten their lives, and live as well as you can in the face of that knowledge. So that means at times you won't be positive at all. You'll be sad, you'll be upset, you'll be frightened. But the interesting thing that I've seen time and again over the 15 years we've run these groups is that shortly after we're there crying about how terrifying this illness is and what it means, we'll be laughing about something else. And what you do is you free people to feel negative feelings and to feel positive feelings, to see the joy as well as the tragedy in life.
How does the support group experience compare to the typical conversations the women in the support group were able to have with their own families?
Well, you know, it depends a lot on how open the families are. But what we found is that there is a kind of intensity about the support groups that many women say is quite different from what they can usually do with their families. They know it's a place where they're going to deal with their worst fears, and it becomes a time and a place to, as one woman put it, feel better about feeling bad. They're with other people who know what they're going through. And so at times it's easier for them to share their fear, their sadness, their frustration, their anger with other women who are in the same boat than it is with family who have their own problems to deal with it as well.
I saw the Bill Moyers program about your support group, and one of the moments that I found really, really moving was when the daughter of one of the women in the group came and spoke with you, and mm-hmm. she was weeping. The daughter, and she said that, you know, her mother was the person who had the most faith in her. She'd had a lot of failures, but her mother always believed that she'd do fine. And she felt that when she lost her mother, she'd be losing her greatest friend and her greatest ally.
Yeah.
But she didn't feel like she could talk like this to her mother because she thought that her mother would fall to pieces if she heard this and that they'd just both weep uncontrollably and it would be miserable. What advice did you give her?
Well, now, I've never lost anybody in terminal weeping, and I advised her very strongly to have that talk with her mother. Now, and this was an unusual situation in that fortunately her mother watched the Bill Moyers show, too, so she got, got the message. But one of the touching things in that meeting, actually, the best advice came from the mother of a woman who was dying, and she said to her daughter, "You're my best friend." They both started to cry, and the daughter said, I knew that, but it means so much more that you've told me that. And I think there are a lot of things that we take for granted that, of course, they know that, and we don't bother telling people, and they're the most important things in life. And the proximity of death, if it's handled right, can get you to say those things that you want to be sure the person knows before they die. Now, that's a kind of a stark and difficult thing, but that's what I indeed encouraged this young woman to do, to talk with her mother. There's nothing terrible about crying together. It can be a wonderful thing.
What's your job as the psychiatrist and leader of the support groups?
My job is to keep it on track, to keep the focus on the feelings. I kind of scan the room looking for signs of emotion, of sadness, of fear, of anger, and encouraging people to talk about that. I cultivate a look of bored inattentiveness when they're talking about, treatment swapping and, you know, what's the latest new far-out treatment to try for cancer, and try to keep the focus on dealing with the hard things. This group is a place to deal with the worst fears and anxieties and share some great joys that people have. But I want to keep it serious and important and focused on dealing with feelings and using it as an occasion where people can feel better about themselves because they can genuinely help one another. For example, one woman who's a newspaper editor was saying that, you know, I'm worried that my husband will have to lose interest in me because I'm not the sharp, witty, hard-edged, tough reporter that he married. I'm getting sort of soft and fuzzy. And another woman in the group said, you know, I like you soft and fuzzy. I think this is a new you and you ought to develop it more. And it was a whole different angle on what she felt she was losing. And that kind of interaction is the kind of thing I really encourage.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. David Spiegel, and he's written a new book called Living Beyond Limits, New Hope and Help for Facing Life-Threatening Illness. Dr. Spiegel directs the Psychosocial Treatment Laboratory at Stanford University, and he's conducted a couple of research studies about the value of support groups for women with metastasized breast cancer. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Dr. David Spiegel is my guest, and his new book, Living Beyond Limits, is about facing life-threatening illness and the advantages of having a support group when you're facing it. You give advice to families who are trying to talk about life-threatening illness. And some of the advice that you give is to state your feelings, not conclusions, to listen and restate what you heard, and to admit when you've had enough, and to choose the right time and place to talk. Why is it important to state your feelings and not conclusions? What do you mean by that?
Well, one of the common problems that we all have in negotiating differences that life forces on us, little ones as well as big ones, is as a way of protecting ourselves, we reach premature conclusions about what other people are doing. So if somebody slights you in some way, you know, and you say to them, you know, you're a jerk or you're always saying stupid things, what can the other person say except fight back? You know, because if they accept it, then they're humiliated by it. If instead you say to them, you really made me feel small or silly when you said that, you're admitting they had an effect on you, and you're not reaching a conclusion about what their motivation was or why they were trying to do it. So it's a way of getting the message across, saying, ouch, it hurt, without making the other person so defensive that they're just going to get angry and tell you you're wrong. So it's a style of communication that has been called non-defensive directness that I think is a way of helping people deal with tough issues in a way that's more constructive.
Why is it important to admit when you've had enough?
Well, I think admitting your emotional limits is very important, particularly in the context of dealing with problems like life-threatening illness. Many people fear that if they get into a discussion about this, they're going to open Pandora's box. The feelings will flow. They'll cry or get angry and never stop. And that doesn't happen, but it's what people fear. And it is true that talking about it can be taxing, not only from the point of view of the person with the disease, but the person who loves them.
You make the point in your book that hope for a cure is just one kind of hope. What are the other kinds of hope that you think, for instance, a support group can offer?
Support groups can offer hope that if you can't be cured, that you can live a very interesting, productive, worthwhile life during the time that you're coping with the progression of the illness. So it's a kind of realistic hope. It's not the false hope that life will be the way it was before this all happened, which is what everybody understandably wants, but many cannot have. But it's a different kind of hope. They can watch somebody who, we had one woman in the group who'd been a frustrated poet all of her life, and before she died, she had written two small, very fine books of poetry. I quote some of her poems in Living Beyond Limits. And so they can see that life isn't over, that it may not go on, you may not die when you're 95 in your sleep, but there's a lot of interesting, worthwhile things that you can do, and you know it's true because you see other people in the same boat as yours who are doing it. So I think it provides a kind of realistic hope in which people kind of redefine the horizons of their life, what the dimensions of it are, but then say, okay, given that, what can I do that I want to do with my life now?
Do you talk about this a lot with the people in the group, the responsibility of the dying to the living?
You bet. That's a major issue. And some lovely things have come of it. I just attended a memorial service for a woman who died several weeks ago. And she sat down and wrote a letter to her 4-year-old that was read at the service, in which she talked about how she had been reluctant to play the piano because she didn't do it perfectly. And she set very high standards to herself. But one day she did, and she turned around and noticed that her 4-year-old was dancing to the music. And she said, "You gave me a gift because I realized I was playing just fine if you could enjoy it that much." And that's a legacy for her daughter. And this is something where she was giving a gift to her daughter that is of tremendous importance.
I don't know exactly what my question is here, but it has to do with acceptance versus anger. When something happens to you very sudden, you know, like suddenly finding out about an illness, your life has changed, and suddenly there's this big line, this big before and after line, mm-hmm. and nothing after will ever be quite the same.
That's right.
And so you could get really angry about it, or you could try to work yourself into this state of acceptance about it, hoping that eventually you will accept it. And you know, I sometimes can't tell which is better. I mean, it seems like anger is really justified, although maybe pointless. And you don't, you know, maybe acceptance too soon is either kidding yourself or giving in when maybe it's better to fight.
Well, I think you're right, Terry. You know, in a sense, you don't control your feelings. You control what you do about them. You control what you think and how you cope. but your feelings happen to you. And I think there's something sometimes phony or unduly constraining about saying, well, you know, I'm supposed to be past this stage now, so I won't be angry. I'll do
right, there's
this.
The four stages of how one copes, blah,
right,
blah.
Right,
yeah.
And people aren't like that. And so what I'm saying is just give yourself room to feel what you feel.
Right.
Now, just because you're angry doesn't mean you go out and do all kinds of crazy things about it. But if you feel that way, feel it. That's okay. And what I find is that people shift from state to state. So for a while, they'll be mad as hell, and then they'll somehow find that they're just not as angry about it as they used to be. But then maybe 2 months later, they will be again, and that's okay. It's a matter of giving yourself permission to feel whatever it is you feel about it.
You've been giving so much thought in the past few years to the relationship between the mind and the body in coping and in healing. Why are so many mainstream doctors so far behind on this, so willing to even entertain the fact that the mind might have something to do with the healing process or with maintaining life a little bit longer?
Well, Terry, you know, medicine has struggled to be a science, and there is always a danger in, you know, if you look through the history of medicine, there have been an awful lot of stupid treatments that have been done because people thought it was right rather than tested to see whether it was right. So I can understand why doctors want to be skeptical and critical and make sure that there's good proof. At the same time, I think we all have trouble getting the possibility that an intangible intervention can have tangible results. And yet, that's the way our bodies work. You know, what do PET scans that show brain function show us, really? That when you choose to do a certain task, the oxygen metabolism and glucose metabolism in certain parts of your brain changes. So what we're learning is that there is an active interaction between what we think and feel and how our brains and endocrine and nervous systems work. And I think our science is beginning to get sophisticated enough that we can understand in traditional Western scientific terms this interaction.
You write that serious illness is not a good thing, but good things can come out of it. I hate hearing that kind of statement from somebody who's a real Pollyanna, but you're not.
Mm-hmm.
So tell me what you mean when you say good things can come of it.
Well, it can. What I mean is, I don't think anybody wishes it on themselves. I think it's a terrible mistake to tell people that they needed their illness and that's why they got it. That's nonsense. But what I am saying is this, that if the illness becomes an occasion for you to take stock of your life and get rid of some things that have been, in retrospect, mistakes, and commit yourself to new things, to tell people you care about how much you care about them, to do things you've been putting off but need doing. It doesn't mean that the illness is good, but it means you can make something good of it. If you can use your experience of coping with cancer to help somebody else get through it better, that is a genuinely good thing that you're doing for someone else that came out of something that's a tragedy. But you know what? A lot of human life is like that. You know, we have to live with tragedy. It's a part of life. And the best things we do in the human condition are making something decent out of those tragedies.
Dr. David Spiegel is a professor of psychiatry at Stanford University and author of the new book, Living Beyond Limits. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Dr. Spiegel will be back with us in the second part of our show.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, the medical uses of hypnosis. We continue our conversation with Dr. David Spiegel. His father did pioneering work in the field. Dr. David Spiegel has used hypnosis to help people with chronic pain and asthma attacks and to ease the nausea caused by chemotherapy. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new recording of the Beethoven Violin Concerto by British violinist Nigel Kennedy, conducted by Klaus Tennstedt. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In New York City, the UN Security Council has voted to once again impose an oil and arms embargo against Haiti. The vote, strongly supported by the United States, came after armed men stopped a UN peacekeeping mission from going ashore this week. The ban goes into effect Monday unless the Haitian government takes steps to honor an agreement that provides for the deployment of a UN mission in efforts to restore democracy to the island. The sanctions also include a freeze on assets held in other nations. Haiti's top military commander says he is prepared to quit, as scheduled, Friday. But he's attached conditions to his departure. NPR's David Wellna reports from Port-au-Prince.
Army General Raoul Cedras said in a news conference today that he's, quote, ready to resign. But he said, first, the Haitian parliament would have to approve a general amnesty, presumably to protect the military from prosecution for deposing Haitian President Jean-Bertrand Aristide 2 years ago. Under the terms of an accord that Cedras signed last July, the military commander and the police chief are both to step down by this Friday to make way for Aristide to return to power October 30th. The commitment of Cedras to that accord, though, has been in doubt, since his forces refused to suppress gun-waving demonstrators who forced a boatload of American soldiers to retreat from Haitian waters yesterday. The soldiers were part of a United Nations effort to retrain the security forces here. Cedras said today any future peacekeeping forces are welcome here, as long as they leave their M-16s at home. I'm David Balna in Port-au-Prince.
Officials of Woolworths have announced plans to close or redesign more than 900 of the company's discount and specialty shops and eliminate thousands of jobs in an effort to improve profits. NPR's Maria Hinojosa has more.
About 400 Woolworths stores are expected to be closed across the country. The other stores owned by the Woolworth Corporation that will be affected include more than 300 Kinney and Foot Quarters shoe stores, and more than 200 stores in Canada will be closed as well. The restructuring will cut the workforce by 10,000 jobs in the United States and by 3,000 in Canada. The layoffs will be split evenly between part-time and full-time positions. Woolworth executives blamed continuing unfavorable economic conditions for the cuts, as well as increased competitiveness in the marketplace. It was also announced today that about 100 of the closed stores will be converted to more profitable specialty stores owned by the Woolworth Corporation. Those include World Foot Locker Athletic Stores and RX The Place Discount Drug Stores. This is the second major cutback by Woolworth in the past 2 years. In New York, this is Maria Hinojosa.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up more than 10 points to close at 3,603.19 on volume of 291 million shares. Declining issues led advances by a slight margin. This is NPR News. With a vote of funding for U.S. efforts in Somalia expected sometime this week, President Clinton has sent a report to Congress terming the mission one of providing a secure environment to allow aid to get through to those who need it. Democratic Senator Robert Byrd has proposed a deadline of pulling U.S. troops out of Somalia of 2 months before the half-year deadline set by the president. However, it's 1 month more than Byrd first proposed. This year's Nobel Prize in Physics goes to two Americans for discovering an unusual star formation, and the Chemistry Prize goes to an American and a Canadian for techniques that they developed that have spurred the biotechnology revolution. NPR's Joe Palca reports.
American Kerry Mullis will share the chemistry prize with Canadian Michael Smith. Mullis developed a technique called PCR that can produce large amounts of DNA from a minute amount of starting material. Smith found a way to make changes in genes inside living cells. Both techniques have enabled biologists to make tremendous strides in understanding how genes work. In physics, Russell Hulse and Joseph Taylor, both now at Princeton University, won the prize for a 1974 discovery. They were looking for pulsars, stars that send regular bursts of energy toward Earth. They found a binary pulsar, one pulsar orbiting around another star. By studying the binary pulsar, they were able to confirm a key prediction of Einstein's theory of general relativity. The prizes will be awarded in Sweden later this year. In Washington, I'm Joe Palca.
According to the American Federation of Teachers, public school teachers are now paid an average of $35,104 a year, an increase of 3.2%. The Federation says that public school teachers' salaries are generally higher in the Northeast and lower in the South, but the survey found the lowest teachers' salaries were in South Dakota, the highest in Connecticut. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Dr. David Spiegel. Dr. Spiegel has written a new book about facing terminal illness called Living Beyond Limits. We discussed that aspect of his work in the first part of the show. We invited him to stay longer to talk about another aspect of his work, the medical use of hypnosis. Dr. Spiegel co-wrote a book on the subject called Trance and Treatment with his father, Dr. Herbert Spiegel, a psychiatrist at Columbia University. Dr. David Spiegel told me about his father's pioneering research into the medical use of hypnosis.
He began using it in World War II. He was trained to use it. He was a battalion surgeon in combat in North Africa. And he was being trained as a psychoanalyst, but you couldn't carry couches with you on the battlefield. So he had to do something more applied and more rapid. And he discovered that that soldiers that had what we would now call acute stress disorder, but was then, a traumatic neurosis, could be helped within, and returned to the front within days rather than being evacuated out never to return with techniques like hypnosis, in which they would relive the stress and gain a new perspective on what they had been through. So when he returned to the United States from the war, he began to use it to treat a variety of problems, to help people stop smoking, to control pain, to deal with anxiety, and found that it became an increasing and is now a pretty much a total part of his psychiatric practice.
I'm sure he was considered pretty kooky, especially at first.
Well, it's interesting, actually. He was worried that he was going to ruin his reputation as an analyst. And Frieda Fromm Reichman, a famous and wonderful psychoanalyst, bawled him out and said, "What are you so worried about your reputation for?" and insisted that he give a seminar on it at the Psychoanalytic Institute that he was training at. So at first it was seen as a rather peripheral thing, but I'm glad to say that as his reputation grew, the interest in the field as a whole did. And it's still not entirely accepted as a mainstream phenomenon, but I'm convinced that it is. And the American Medical Association, the American Psychiatric Association, certify it as a mainstream legitimate medical technique, and it's taught at the best medical schools in the country.
Now, what do we mean by hypnosis? You know, the pop culture cliche of hypnosis is that some guy makes you watch look at a watch that's swinging back and forth, and then you're in a trance, and then he says, "When I snap my fingers, you will think you are a chicken." And he snaps his fingers, and then you start squawking.
Well, it doesn't work with digital watches, you know.
Right.
That's the problem. All that hypnosis really is a state of focused, attentive concentration with a suspension of peripheral awareness. And you don't need a dangling watch. In fact, if you're hypnotizable, you do it all the time. Have you ever had the experience of being in a good movie and getting so caught up in the movie that you forgot you're watching a movie, you know, and then when the thing's over, you kind of have a little jarring experience of reorienting? Has that ever happened to you?
Sure, yeah.
Well, that's a hypnotic-like state. It's the suspension of disbelief. You're not critically judging it. You're just experiencing it. So anytime we narrow the focus of attention, it's sort of like looking through a telephoto lens instead of a wide-angle lens. You see something very clearly, but ignore the context, and you don't judge it. That's a hypnotic-like state. You put certain things out of your conscious awareness that could be in your conscious awareness, and you focus very intently on one or two things. That's a hypnotic state.
Now, how do you use that? How do you channel that to control pain?
Well, right now, Terry, if you're sitting in a chair.
Yeah.
Okay. You have sensations from your back and your legs touching the chair, I presume.
Mm-hmm.
But until I mentioned it, hopefully you were not aware of them. You were more interested in what I was saying. In the same way, we're constantly directing our attention toward certain things and away from other things. We do it instinctively. We have to, or otherwise we'd be overwhelmed by perceptual input. Now, if you can do it with normal sensations, like touching the chair, you can do it with abnormal sensations, like pain. Most people with chronic pain, for example, find that it's worse evenings and weekends than it is during the day. Why? Because they're absorbed during the day doing their work or schooling or whatever it is, and it's when you have time to sit back and ponder it that the pain seems to get worse. So what you can learn with this focusing of attention in hypnosis is to say, I'm going to focus on a sense of floating or lightness or warmth or coolness or on sensations in some other part of my body, and you simply pay less attention to the pain signals.
Now, how do you direct somebody to focus their attention away from their pain onto something else?
Well, the crucial thing is you don't fight the pain. You know, if you do that, you'll make it worse instead of better. Instead, you focus on some absorbing image. I often ask people to imagine that they're floating in a bath or a lake or in California, hot tubs are popular, or just floating in space, and absorb yourself in that image. See what it feels like to be floating in a hot tub. So you're not simply remembering it, you're trying to re-experience it. And as you do that, you'll notice that the tension in your body tends to decrease, and you can start to concentrate on what it would feel like to be floating in a hot tub. And these gradually become sensations that can become a kind of filter between you and the pain. So you still know the pain is there, but you experience it through this filter of warmth or coolness or lightness.
My guest is Dr. David Spiegel, author of the new book, Living Beyond Limits. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Dr. David Spiegel. He's a professor of psychiatry at Stanford University. Does tension intensify pain?
Absolutely. Muscle tension increases pain. You can make your muscles hurt right now by just squeezing them tight enough until they hurt. And yet what most people do when they have pain is they splint the area around the pain. They pull on it, and they literally will produce more pain. So if you can simply stop fighting it by tensing up your muscles, you can reduce literally the amount of pain that you experience.
Now, if hypnosis is a temporary, almost trance-like state in which you're concentrating on one thing and not another, when you kind of get up out of your chair and stop focusing on the warm bath or whatever, will the effects of that stay with you?
It varies. For some people, it does, because you've interrupted this cycle. One thing that's known about pharmacologic treatment of pain as well is that if you break the cycle early, you do much better. The cycle of pain, because it seems to set up a kind of feedback in the nervous system where the signal's coming in, the brain is disinhibiting it, more signals coming in, and it kind of builds, you get more anxious and unhappy and tense, and on it goes.
Right, because even with painkillers now, I think the new way of thinking is you should take a painkiller before the pain intensifies to its ultimate limit.
That's exactly right. Get it early. And
yeah.
The same is true for psychological techniques like hypnosis. So in some way, you interrupt the cycle. But I think the other thing that may not be clear to the listeners is, you know, a hypnotic state is not something that you have to attain after a half an hour and that you stay in and you're out of it and then you return to ordinary life. It's something you can shift into in a matter of seconds. It's just a state of focused concentration. So many people who are good at this learn to shift in and out of this hypnotic-like state all the time to reinforce their control and then go on about what they're doing. So although most people would say that the pain control is best when they're in the hypnotic state, many find that they get a fair amount of relief for some time, minutes to hours afterwards, and they can very quickly reestablish that control.
Now, you even advise your patients who, for instance, are going for chemotherapy treatments to leave their bodies behind, just to kind of get out of their bodies. So why don't I ask you to explain what you tell them?
Well, it's a typical Californian trick, where, as people have out-of-body experiences. But one of the things that happens with chemotherapy is you get a kind of conditioned nausea and vomiting, where you know that the chemotherapy is likely to make you nauseated. So just thinking about going to the hospital or the smell of the chemicals in the hospital tends to provoke another attack of nausea and vomiting. And what we teach people to do is to say, I've got to deliver my body here, but I don't particularly want to be here. So you just have them focus on going somewhere else. One woman, I used to have her picture going on a trip, but she got a little bored with that because she likes to keep herself busy. So she imagined that she had purchased a castle on the Rhine, and while she was getting her chemotherapy, she was redecorating it room by room. And she got completely absorbed in that, and it was a way of detaching herself from the normal reaction, the feedback of input and output that tends to lead to tremendous discomfort.
What are some of the other ways that you use this kind of focused concentration now?
Well, hypnosis can be very helpful for habit control, like smoking. We just completed a study, actually, with my father, Herbert Spiegel, showing that one out of four patients given a single session of self-hypnosis will not take another cigarette in 2 years, 2 years follow-up. It can be very helpful for anxiety control, helping people, rather than kind of swimming in their problems, to picture them on an imaginary screen, and you can play with them in a sense. You can make them bigger or smaller, or change the context, or see what you're going to do about a problem that had previously seemed overwhelming. And you learn in hypnosis to dissociate the somatic reaction of tension from the content of the idea in your mind. And that can be a way of not getting into this snowball effect of something that worries you creating physical tension that makes you more worried and so on. So it can be very useful as an anxiety control technique as well.
Did your father ever teach you hypnosis when you were growing up?
I'm certain he did. I watched with interest what he was doing. I occasionally got to see a videotape that he did. And when I was in medical school, I went down to Columbia. I was up at Harvard, but I would come down on Saturdays to Columbia and take his hypnosis course. And so, yes, I did learn a lot about what he was doing with it.
Everybody's going to be wondering, did he experiment on you?
God help us. No, I don't think so. At least I'm not consciously aware that
right.
he did, but you right. never know.
Now, you tell a story in your book about how when you came out of med school, I think it was like early in your career as a doctor, you had a patient who was having a terrible asthma attack. The medicine was not helping her. So you decided to use some self-hypnosis. Tell us what happened.
I was a medical student then at Children's Hospital, and they informed me that my next patient was down the hall. It was an asthmatic in what's called status asthmaticus, which meant that she hadn't responded to medication. And I just followed the sound of the wheezing down the hall. And I walk in the room, and there is this 15-year-old redhead bolt upright in bed, wheezing, knuckles white, mother wringing her hands. And I didn't know what else to do. So I had just taken a hypnosis course in medical school and said, would you like to learn an exercise to help your breathing? And she nodded. And so then I realized that I better figure out what to say to her because I'd never treated an asthmatic before with hypnosis. So I hypnotized her and said something very sophisticated. Each breath you take will be a little deeper and a little easier. And within 5 minutes, she's lying back in bed. Her knuckles aren't white. The wheezing is better. And the nurse ran out and filed a complaint with the nursing supervisor who accused me of hypnotizing a minor without parental consent, although her mother was in the room, and there is no such law in Massachusetts. So we went through several days of argument about whether this was dangerous or not. And finally, the intern had a great idea. She said, let's let the patient decide. And the patient said, I like this. Well, this young woman had been hospitalized every month for the last 3 months. She had one subsequent hospitalization but hasn't been hospitalized since, and learned self-hypnosis and for a while was learning to be a respiratory therapist to help other people deal with it. So I figured that anything that could help the patient that tangibly and violate Massachusetts law had to be worth looking into.
How do you use self-hypnosis yourself?
I use it a lot for anxiety control when I'm preparing a big talk or something. I will put myself into a state of self-hypnosis, use an imaginary screen, get my body floating and comfortable, and outline the major points that I want to cover in the talk. I've also used it for pain control. I had a recurrent dislocating shoulder, and I had surgery on it. And it was 3-hour surgery. I decided to let the anesthesiologist take care of me during it. But afterwards, I used self-hypnosis for pain control and didn't use any medication. And after a day or two, I walked over and read my medical record. I wasn't supposed to do that, but I did since I was a doctor. And the surgeon wrote, patient using little pain medication, we mustn't have cut many nerves.
No, they always take credit for it.
Right, exactly.
So you didn't tell the doctors who were attending you that you were using self-hypnosis?
No, I was afraid they'd put me on antipsychotics.
So how much... how kooky are you considered now for practicing hypnosis?
Well, you probably have to ask someone else. But I think I'm glad to say that I think it's becoming a much more widely accepted technique and being seen as a serious, scientifically, studyable phenomenon. I teach a course on it at Stanford Medical School, and there are courses at Harvard and University of Pennsylvania and many fine medical schools. And we're also learning something more about the science of it. We've done some studies looking at brain electrical activity, showing that when you hypnotize someone and give them the analgesia instruction, their brains actually respond less to the same signals, that you can show a reduction in the amplitude of the electrical activity over the part of the brain that is responding to these signals. So we're beginning to see that there is a brain connection here, and that when somebody tells you they're feeling less pain, they're actually feeling less pain. Their brain is damping down their response to the signal.
Dr. David Spiegel is a professor of psychiatry at Stanford University. His new book about facing terminal illness is called Living Beyond Limits. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Hi, Terry. David Wellner reports today from Port-au-Prince, Haiti, where people there figure that the reimposition of economic sanctions is something that's going to happen. Also today on our program, the Supreme Court hears arguments in a case involving sexual harassment in the workplace. Joe Palca tells us about the Nobel Prize winners in physics and chemistry. Linda Gradstein reporting from Taba in Egypt on the first round of negotiations for the PLO-Israel peace agreement. And I'll talk with a drugstore owner in Arkansas. He and two other pharmacy owners have won a lawsuit in that state, charging Walmart with predatory pricing.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. A lot of good recordings of Beethoven's violin concerto, but classical music critic Lord Schwartz says the new one with the young British violinist Nigel Kennedy and the German conductor Klaus Tennstedt is very special.
The Beethoven Violin Concerto is a masterpiece, but it's not one of Beethoven's heaviest or deepest works. It has a youthful radiance, and this lovely performance, recorded live at a concert in Germany last year, captures its special sweetness with the most touching inwardness. The violin soloist is the iconoclastic young Nigel Kennedy, who looks more like a punk rocker than a classical virtuoso. The conductor is perhaps our best-loved living classical maestro, Klaus Tennstedt, whose bouts with cancer in recent years have made each of his appearances all the more precious. This is a surprisingly sympathetic collaboration. Too good for Kennedy's defensive, almost paranoid liner notes about the more snobby members of the British elitist press. He attacks what he calls the intellectually self-satisfied crap written about the music of dead composers or alive, brain-dead ones elected worthy of consideration by the critics' clique. Is Kennedy so committed to his hip image that he's nervous about being regarded as a serious musician? For example, Beethoven didn't leave a written solo cadenza for this concerto. Kennedy plays Fritz Kreisler's brilliant but traditional cadenza in the first movement, but in the third movement, he improvises his own cadenza. These are interesting choices. Why should he feel he has to refer to them, as he does in his note, as boring details? Listen to the end of Kennedy's own cadenza. It's extremely original and compelling, and really needs no apology. ¶¶ Kennedy congratulates himself for being in contact with the music. And he really is. So it's too bad he's being packaged more as a personality than as a distinguished artist. The recording begins not with music, but with a minute and 22 seconds of tuning and applause. The back cover says in big print, "The new real live recording." After I saw the album and read the notes, I thought I'd hate the performance. But it's the music that counts, and both the concerto and Kennedy's exciting encores, two Bach movements for solo violin, turn out to be worth our most serious attention.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed a new recording of the Beethoven Violin Concerto, played by Nigel Kennedy and conducted by Klaus Tennstedt. It's on EMI. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our program was produced today by Fred Landrell. Our engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman and Chris Fraley. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by the National Endowment for the Arts and by the Vanguard Group of Investment Companies with 74 mutual fund portfolios offering comprehensive investment and retirement services. 1-800-643-3395. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Tim Green is not your typical football player. The Atlanta Falcons defensive end is also a columnist, NPR commentator, law student, and now novelist. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Tim Green about life in the NFL. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.